This is number 0035, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0035. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet Brian Merzbach, who runs the website ballparkreviews.com. He travels all over the place checking out ballparks. Where did the idea come from?
So I've had the website really since 1997. You know, I've had it up for about 13 years. The traveling to the different ballparks really started out as family vacations in the in the late 1980s, as you said, 1988. The inspiration really probably came from an uncle of mine who did some traveling to all the major league parks back in 1977. So that's really where the idea came from to go around to visit different ballparks.
Filmmaker Lulu Keating talks about her soon-to-be-made film entitled Based on a True Fantasy, and even though it's not made yet, it's already won an award. What will the movie be about?
Well, it's the story of a woman who came to age in her sexual maturity in the 70s and was swept away in the whole free love era with exploring and experimenting and searching for the next big thrill until she finally, as she ages, discovers what she wants is to have a child, and through that process and finding someone to fertilize her egg becomes matures and accepts that what she was really looking for all along was not free love but herself, and finds herself in this process.
You'll hear from Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation.
No matter what you do, there are some people who are determined to put the emphasis on the wrong syllable. I could harp about this, but I probably won't, because it's really a mute point. Or is that a moot point? Hi, this is Steve Walsh. You know, your guy in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. You're going to want to stick around for my two-minute tirade. It's coming up later on, right here on the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And, of course, we have lots and lots and lots of stuff and an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0035, was Jamie Orchard, Montreal's global news anchor. You can catch her weekdays at 6 p.m. Check your local listings for the cable channel, and if you have Bell ExpressView, you can find it at channel 234. Thank you very much, Jamie, for doing this week's slate on the Stuff File program. Let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Okay, you know, Robert Hodges lives on a quiet street in Daytona Beach, Florida, but he became rather angry with his neighbors after they complained about the wood deck he added to his home that prompted county officials to cite him for a code violation. So Robert decided to give them really something to complain about. He painted his house randomly with purple, yellow, orange, green, and pink, added a toilet and rusting bike stand by a tree, old pieces of his wood deck are scattered around the yard, and he built a large sand mound decorated with skis, golf clubs, plastic ducks, and Christmas ornaments. Crisscrossing the front yard are several clotheslines featuring boxers, a pair of hot pink feathery panties, and colorful extra-large bras. We should mention that Mr. Hodges prefers to be called Prince Mongo, says he is 333 years old, and hails from the planet Zambodia. But he's just the latest to join the colorful cast of other Central Florida characters who use their homes as a canvas for protest. Like the others, Prince Mongo is not going to back down from his fight to do with his property as he pleases. But this is nothing new for the prince. Before he retired to Florida, he lived in Memphis, where his claim to fame was his front yard piled with toilet bowls, mannequin heads, lampshades, and traffic cones. He fought code enforcement battles in the 70s, and in 2002 hired highly paid lawyers to argue his case. Volusia County Councilman Josh Wagner says, "He's not dumb, he knows the law, and he knows he can't be cited for hanging 100 pieces of women's underwear, so he's pushing the limits of that." As for Prince Mongo, he says, He just wants to be left alone. Okay, moving right along, supervisors at the Department of Works and Pension in Carlisle, England, issued a directive in March to shorthanded staff on how to ease their telephone workload during the busy midday period. Now get this. Workers were told to pick up the ringing phone and recite a message as if it were an answering machine. Something like, "Due to the high volume of inquiries we are currently experiencing, we are unable to take your call. Please call back later." And then they just hang up. Really? If that's the case, first of all, it's their job to answer the phones. And if they're too busy to answer the phones, don't answer the phone. Anyway, that's just weird. Moving right along, the name keeps changing to protect the guilty. That's the headline of this story. And according to Franklin County, Alabama District Attorney Joey Rushing, the homeowner showed great restraint in the incident. He says Gene Timms, age 65, broke into a home in Franklin early in the morning, waking up the residents. When the man of the house demanded to know why he was there, Timms allegedly told him he was Jesus Christ and was there to have sex with the homeowner's wife and daughter. After a brief standoff, the homeowner says Timms said he was Elvis Presley and pulled his pants down. Meanwhile, someone else in the family had called 911, and when officers arrived, Timms ran with his pants still around his knees. He was arrested, charged with burglary, attempted indecent exposure, and resisting arrest. After the arrest, Timms told officers he was Harry Houdini's grandson and could easily escape them. Just based on the circumstances, Rush said, "We'll be asking the state to conduct a mental evaluation on the suspect." Yeah, that sounds like a plan. And how about cycling for your supper? Remember last week, if you were listening to the show, we told you about a prison in the U.S. that is using pedal power so that the televisions will work? Well, here's another similar story. A Danish hotel is pioneering a pedal power electricity generation scheme that it hopes will catch on in other countries. The Crown Plaza Copenhagen Towers, 15 minutes from the center of the Danish capital and 5 minutes from Scandinavia's main airport, is installing two exercise bicycles hooked up to generators. Guests will be invited to jump on and start pedaling. And if they produce enough electricity, they will be given a free meal. From June, they will be able to race against the 366-room hotel's solar panel system in a bid to produce the most electricity. Anyone producing 10 watt-hours of electricity or more for the hotel will be given a locally produced complimentary meal, encouraging guests to not only get fit, but also reduce their carbon footprint and save electricity and money, the hotel said in a statement. A hotel spokeswoman said the free meal offer applied only to paying guests, not passers-by. The value of the meal, any one of the main courses on the hotel, restaurant, or lobby bar's menu, is about 240 Danish crowns. That's about $44 U.S. The electric bikes are up and running, and the plan is to test the idea for a year with a view to expanding it to more Crown Plaza hotels. The Crown Plaza hotels are part of the Intercontinental Hotels Group. And perhaps you're aware that Pope Benedict XVI is planning a visit to the UK in September. It'll be the first UK visit by a sitting pope since 1982. And two British atheists, Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, want to be ready for the big event. They are consulting with lawyers to see that the pope can be arrested and tried for crimes against humanity because they believe he has been complicit in the cover-up of sex abuse crimes committed by priests in the U.S., Ireland, Austria, and Germany. Dawkins and Hitchens say the pope should be tried before the International Criminal Court in The Hague at the Netherlands. Yeah, well, good luck with that, guys. I know you're both atheists, so let's just say, when it comes to this particular case, you don't have a prayer. Moving right along, in Hayfield, England, Joan Hall had parked her Toyota Yaris sports car while she ran into the post office. Very fortunately, she was not in the car when a gigantic 5-ton boulder fell off a semi-flatbed truck and landed squarely on top of the vehicle, crushing it like a cheap beer can. The boulder was so heavy that the crane trying to remove it dropped it back on the car on the first try. Yet amazingly, Ms. Hall later told reporters, "I've had a lot of things happen to me in my life. This is actually a minor one. I'm going to have to write a book one of these days." Having your car crushed by a boulder is one of the minor incidents in your life? What must her life be like? Wow, that's some interesting life this woman has if getting her car crushed by a boulder is a minor story. Anyway, elsewhere, Roberta Finesmith, age 67, who has been fired by the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York City, filed a wrongful discharge lawsuit in February claiming that, despite glowing job reviews for 12 years, she was terminated because of her age and because she complained to other workers about her recently hired supervisor's constant barrages of flatulence. Yes, it's a gas. And finally, in this section of the Stuff File with me, Peter Anthony Holder, police who were called to a home in Pennsylvania in February arrested Linda Newstrom, age 49, for allegedly swinging a baseball bat, reportedly a genuine Louisville Slugger, at her 21-year-old son, Jeffrey, because he had come home drunk. She whiffed on the first two swings, but connected on the third, by the way. Newstrom told police, "I brought him into this world, and I can take him out of this world." Yeah, there's a loving family, huh? Let's talk about baseball, but from a more humane angle, and that brings us to our first guest. A man in Middleton, New York, sure knows his baseball after visiting more than 290 ballparks. Since 1988, Brian Merzbach has been trekking to major and minor league ballparks across America. There are two reasons for that, and I'll let him explain them to you. Brian joins us on the line right now. Hi, Brian. How are you?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on with us. So, what are the two reasons that you've decided to trek to more than 290 ballparks?
Well, first of all, is obviously I love baseball. I've grown up playing baseball as a youngster, and then always loved going to games as a youngster. So that's the primary reason that I go around to the different ballparks, but also. I go to photograph them and to do reviews for my website. So those are the two primary reasons. And also it's just a great way to see the country. See the United States. See various cities that I would normally never see.
Well, obviously, as you say, your love for baseball goes back to childhood. But when did you decide to turn it into the website ballparkreviews.com?
So I've had the website really since 1997. So really, I've had it up for about 13 years. The traveling to the different ballparks really started out as family vacations in the late 1980s, as you said, 1988. The inspiration really probably came from an uncle of mine who did some traveling to all the major league parks back in 1977. So that's really where the idea came from to go around to visit different ballparks. So I've just kind of expanded it to include a lot of minor league parks as well.
Okay, so 290 ballparks, obviously some of them are major and some of them are minor leagues. Do you have a favorite, and would people be surprised what your favorite ballpark is?
Well, from a major league perspective, my favorites are Fenway Park and Wrigley Field from the old style ballparks. I grew up a Red Sox fan, so I guess I'm partial to Fenway Park as being my favorite among at least the old style ballparks. Among the new ballparks, I really like PNC Field in Pittsburgh and AT&T Field in San Francisco. Those are my two favorites among the new ones. And then in the minor leagues, among the minor league parks, there's a lot of nice new ballparks that have been built. A lot of them seem to be kind of cookie cutter nowadays, so I guess I'm partial to a lot of the any of the older ballparks that remain in the minor leagues, though there aren't too many of them. So,
now, what do you, besides going to all these ballparks and obviously putting pictures up of the ballparks on your site, I understand you rate some of the things that go on at the sites and some of the attractions and even the concessions?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I basically grade the ballparks, on my site on three different aspects. The overall ballpark, from an architecture perspective, how good it is a place to see a game from a viewing the game aspect. And then I've got the atmosphere. What does the team do, to try to make the atmosphere more lively? How good are the fans there? And then the concessions is the third thing that I rate the ballparks in. What's the variety of food options and how good is the quality of the food?
Now, you mentioned you're a fan of the Red Sox and Fenway Park, and I have to mention right now that so am I, and I don't know of a better hot dog than the Ballpark Frank at Fenway.
Yeah, I know a lot of people seem to be partial to it. I did have one, you know, last year when I went. And it's the first one I've had, I think, probably in several years when I've gone there. And it was pretty tasty, but I guess I'm more partial actually to grilled hot dogs as opposed to boiled hot dogs, which Fenway Franks are. I don't typically eat hot dogs at most of the parks because I do get tired of them. So I like to try the local favorites. You know, a lot of the parks have, you know, local specialties that are more regional favorites. So I try to get those as much as possible when I go to these ballparks.
Since you started the website ballparkreviews.com, and as you say, it's more than a decade now. Have you heard from some of the ballparks that are rated on your site? Are they aware of who you are when you show up at the ballpark, or do you just go incognito and they're not aware of you, or you haven't heard from them at all?
Yeah, that's right. I try to go incognito. I really don't let the teams know when I'm coming. I just want to go as a regular fan and not be treated any differently than any other fan. I mean, I think that's the best way to get the full experience of, you know, what it's like to attend a game there, rather than, you know, being treated differently and maybe being, you know, put up in a luxury box or something, which I don't think is the real ballpark atmosphere experience.
Which brings me to the question, where do you find the best seating is? And I'll go back to Fenway, someplace that I've been several times. I've been lucky enough to sit in the grandstands in box seats and also as a bleacher creature. And I would assume for different parks, there are different places that are best suited to being a fan. Where is your favorite spot in any given park? And let's start with Fenway.
Well, Fenway, I mean, I guess I always prefer to be as close to the action as possible. So, I mean, I would always prefer to sit, you know, in the box seats, you know, behind one of the dugouts. I don't like to sit behind the screen, you know, because your view is obstructed somewhat. But so I like to be, you know, down the lines behind one of the dugouts as close to the field as possible. I know a lot of the new parks now, that's not practical. Either they're season tickets or those tickets are just outrageously expensive and not something, you know, I want to spend hundreds of dollars on. So, you know, a lot of the major league parks now I end up sitting, you know, usually in the upper deck behind home plate or, you know, around the infield someplace. So definitely I like to be on the infield. I'm not one that likes to sit in the bleachers, generally speaking. I mean, I've done it a few times, but mostly I like to, you know, sit closer to the infield.
Is there a park or are there parks you don't like?
Yeah, there's always parks that I don't like. I mean, I think a lot of it has to do more with the atmosphere at a ballpark, or perhaps the setting is just, you know, it's just boring. That would lead me to not like a ballpark. I mean, I think like I said, primarily it would be the atmosphere. If the team goes overboard with, you know, sound effects or you know, silly games and stuff and distracts too much from the game, that's when I would, you know, tend to not like a ballpark. But overall, I mean, I think I enjoy the most of the ballparks that I go to. So I can't really say I dislike, you know, that many.
Now, you mentioned Fenway, you mentioned Wrigley, two traditional parks that you like. You also, I believe, mentioned PNC Field in Pittsburgh, which is a newer park. Mm-hmm. Generally speaking, how do you feel about some of the newer parks?
I mean, most of them I enjoy going to. Like I said, I think a lot of them are becoming a bit cookie cutter nowadays. A lot of them are doing the same, a lot of the same things, you know, these so-called retro parks. I mean, overall, they're obviously a vast improvement over the parks that were built, you know, back in the 70s and 60s when a lot of them, you know, were the true multi-purpose cookie cutter stadiums like, you know, Three Rivers and Riverfront and Busch Stadium. Those three come to mind. So they're definitely there. You know, these baseball only ballparks are a great improvement, and I love the fact that a lot of the parks are going back, you know, into the city, to build them rather than putting them, you know, someplace on the outskirts in the middle of a big open parking lot. You know, that's what we've seen, and you know, especially like in places like Pittsburgh and Detroit. I mean, they've really tried to incorporate it into the downtown, and you get to see, you know, great views of the skyline, you know, while you're watching the game. So that's something I really like.
Do you get a lot of response from people either who follow what you do on your website or add their own ideas as to ballparks they like or don't like?
Oh yeah, I get quite a few emails from people that are, you know, commenting on ballparks that they frequent. Some of the responses are not, they don't always agree with me. I mean, I've especially at the minor league level, I probably bashed some ballparks, and people don't like that. But it's just one man's opinion. So, that's what the point of the website is to be able to express my opinions on these ballparks.
And do you ever take into consideration what the team does as far as relationship with the fans and how the fans are in a ballpark? Does that affect your rating of particular ballparks at ballparkreview.com?
Sure. I mean, I think that would go into the atmosphere category, which I do a ranking. I mean, places like, Boston and Fenway Park and St. Louis, where the fans are really knowledgeable and pretty rabid. I think that definitely goes into the atmosphere. Philadelphia, New York. I mean, those places, they have great fans. I mean, no doubt about it. So, I mean, that definitely adds to the ballpark experience.
And one last question, since you review parks, not just major league, but also minor leagues, we talked about your favorite parks in the major league situation. What would you consider to be a hidden gem? And I'm guessing this is a minor league park.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, I've been to so many minor league parks. I mean, like I said, I mean, I think there's, I'd split it up into old parks and new parks at the minor league level. I mean, there's two old parks that actually aren't really in use anymore, Wacona Park in Pittsfield and Rickwood Field in Birmingham, Alabama, which are two great old classic ballparks that don't host minor league baseball anymore. Actually, Wacona Park is going to be having a team this year, but and Rickwood Field hosts one game a year for the Birmingham Barons, but and in terms of new parks, I think the one in Staten Island, which has a great view of Lower Manhattan, is probably an underrated ballpark that I don't hear a lot of people talking about for some reason. Even though it is in the New York area, the Brooklyn ballpark there actually gets a lot more publicity. So those are the ones that jump out to me.
Well, people can check out your website and check out all the parks and see the reviews. The website is ballparkreviews.com as we start another baseball season and people are saying play ball. I thank you very much, Brian, for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Okay, well, thanks for having me.
Brian Merzbach, who runs the website ballparkreviews.com. That's ballparkreviews.com. You can check it out, and you can also find links to it on my website, thestufffile.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
If you're into the paranormal, then you're into Don Ecker and Dark Matters.
Something I have been immersed in for 20 years. Lunar research on items known as lunar transient phenomena. For over 400 years, world-class astronomers have been observing strange sights, lights, flashes, and other things on the moon.
Provocative topics, listeners' calls, and interesting guests.
My guest, Mr. Alan Stern.
On my website, I have a list of 100 or so lunar conspiracy theories. I had to kind of come to terms with one of them that I hadn't really thought about.
It's the kind of show that might keep you up at night.
Speculation is, at some time in our past, or perhaps even today, there is another presence on the moon. And I'm not talking about indigenous lunar folks. I'm talking about a space base by somebody else on the far side of the moon.
Dark Matters with Don Ecker, exclusively on CyberStationUSA.com.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's radio that puts a smile on your face and a skip in your step. Please avoid skipping if you are driving.
And still to come on the Stuff File program, we'll meet filmmaker Lulu Keating. Plus, we'll hear from Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. And, of course, we have an idiot of the day. But right now, more stuff right here for you. And, you know, we thought it kind of goes without saying that you usually don't want to bring loaded guns into the mix when you're having foreplay with your girlfriend and you're both drunk. But in Granite Falls, Washington, a 25-year-old man says he accidentally shot to death his 22-year-old girlfriend doing just that. The guy told detectives that he and his girlfriend of 10 years had been drinking at a party in their home and then went to bed to get busy. He told police that he rubbed the loaded handgun all over his girlfriend after consuming more than a six-pack of beer. He said his girlfriend drank six bottles of Mike's Hard Lemonade. Then, after the lovin', he said they forgot about the gun until he found it at the foot of the bed and picked it up. When he swung his arm toward his girlfriend, it went off. He then called 911, and in an interview with police, he called himself an idiot several times and implied he would hurt himself for what he'd done. A background check on the man did indicate that there had been three previous domestic violence incidents involving the couple between 2007 and 2009, with the girlfriend as the victim. Police are still investigating. Methinks he's going to jail. That's all I'm saying. On to Maryland for our next story. A burglary suspect came up with a creative explanation after he was found dangling from a ventilation system at a Maryland convenience store. He told police he had been playing hide-and-seek. Cecil County Sheriff's deputies said the owner of a BP convenience store in Northeast was opening up Wednesday morning when he spotted a pair of feet dangling from a duct. Detectives responded and freed a 20-year-old man. Deputies said the man removed a ventilation cover and crawled through the vent before getting stuck and setting off a fire extinguisher that sprayed powder all over the store. The man told deputies he was playing hide-and-seek on the roof with other adults and decided to hide in the ventilation system. He said the other players couldn't figure out where he was and stop looking for him. Well, I guess he won then. Yeah. Elsewhere, Michael Kelly, age 31, got a call from his mother. She was hysterical. His son was missing, she said. Terrified, he raced over to her house at speeds of 120 miles per hour to rescue his 9-year-old. After blowing through a red light, Rowan County, North Carolina deputies pulled him over, or at least they tried to. He kept going, leading a chase. When they finally got him to stop, Kelly was arrested and charged with a red light violation, driving with a suspended license, and speeding to elude arrest, which is a felony. Oh, and the little boy? Just fine. It was April 1st, and Kelly's mother was just playing an April Fool's joke on him. What a fun-loving mom! Ah, good times, good times. When the court orders her to take care of the child while Kelly's in prison, will that be good or bad? I'm not sure. But gosh, she's a fun-loving grandma, isn't she? Yeah. Laughs all the way around. Elsewhere, Willie McTire, age 29, of Niagara Falls, New York, says he was just minding his own business outside a bar when he was shot. He said he was sitting in his car in the parking lot when he heard gunshots, this according to the city's chief of detectives, and then a bullet hit his windshield and then struck him in the forehead. Sounds bad, but it was just a flesh wound, the detective said, and McTire was released after being treated at a local hospital. The weird part? Almost the same thing happened to McTire 3 months before outside a different bar in the city. Police said the two shootings don't appear to be related. Well, the target is, apparently, but the two shootings? Nah, just a coincidence. And finally, in this section of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. They say kids grow up so fast, huh? Yeah, way too fast for one third grader in Wilkinsburg, Pennsylvania. Police said the 8-year-old from Turner Elementary School handed out more than 60 small bags of heroin to his classmates before his teacher discovered them. While some of the bags were found empty in a trash can, there was no evidence the kids had ingested the drugs. Police say the bags were stamped with the words, "Trust me." Police are now investigating how the boy got the drugs to begin with, and they have sent a letter home to parents about the incident. Boy, that must be some fun reading for the parents, huh? I'm just picturing that letter. Dear parents, we're sorry to report that your kid may have done a little heroin today at school. Let us explain. Yes, explain indeed. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. On the line with us right now is award-winning filmmaker Lulu Keating. She is the 2010 recipient of the Women in the Director's Chair Feature Film Award, presented by Creative Women Workshops Association. She got her award as part of the opening gala at the 2010 Women in Film Festival, which is taking place in Vancouver, British Columbia. She joins us now from Vancouver. Hi, Lulu. Thanks for joining us, and congratulations.
Thank you very much. I'm absolutely just clawing myself away from that glass ceiling now, trying to get my feet back on the ground. It's really thrilling.
What does getting this award mean to you?
Well, basically, we're probably, depending on which budget we look at, a third of the way away from getting our total financing, or a seventh of the way away from getting the money that we need to make this film. So it's a feature film. It's a movie. And the award is both services and some cash, so that we will have access to a studio we can shoot in for a week, and sound and picture post-production facilities and equipment. And if they have the money when we're ready for it, BC Film for a portion of that as well.
Now, I understand the film is entitled Based on a True Fantasy. Is that the film?
That's the name of it.
And what's it about?
Well, it's the story of a woman who grew up, came to age in her sexual maturity in the 70s, and was swept away in the whole free love era with exploring and experimenting and searching for the next big thrill, until she finally, as she ages, discovers what she wants is to have a child, and through that process and finding someone to fertilize her egg, matures and accepts that what she was really looking for all along was not free love, but herself, and finds herself in this process. And just what the film will look like is going to be, I think, different from anything we've seen before. It was conceived of with this award in mind, where it would be shot in a studio and a very low-budget film. So the idea is that we may see Lucille, our main character, walk into a bar, and behind her, the bar is drawn in as she progresses through an empty space, and the background is suddenly revealed, drawn as she sits at a real table, and some real characters will come in, real people, actors, but there might be a conglomerate mass of drawn characters in the background. So it'll be a combination of, shooting against green screen and doing these drawings as scenes are revealed, and front screen projection, rear projection, all kinds of different animated techniques that combine to tell the whole story.
As a filmmaker, getting the opportunity to use this kind of technology yourself, does it free you? Does it give you creative license to go further than you normally would, because you can create so many things within this studio setting and with the green screen effect, as opposed to, and budget-wise, as opposed to going out and shooting it?
Yeah, it's absolutely, totally, exhilaratingly freeing. So for me, I've already done quite a bit of animation over the years, and I did a film called The Moody Brood, which was about my family, all animated 40-minute film that was on CBC News World. And I've also directed dramas, a feature film 20 years ago, and short dramas. So to combine the two is really exciting, to be able to feel as if, the script has to be really tight, the story has to have a linear progression to it, with all the necessary, character arcs and nuances of story, and be satisfying on all of those fronts. But then within what it's going to look like, the sky's the limit. The narrative can be augmented or interrupted at any point by a flight of fancy that takes us into the next moment.
I mentioned in the introduction that the award that you've just won and the event that you're taking part in deals primarily with women in films. And, of course, this is a year where a woman has finally broken that glass ceiling and won as Best Director for the Oscars. How big of a deal is that for you and some of your compatriots in seeing that happen? And will that change things, or is this just a slight blip in the ever-ongoing struggle?
Well, you know, if I was younger, I'd probably feel like, okay, now we've turned things around. You know, population-wise, it should be every second year that a woman would win the Academy Award, the Oscar. Is it going to be that? Absolutely not, because only 10% of feature films, which is, you know, the high-budget feature films, I mean, the higher-stakes kind of film production, that's only 10% of feature films are made by women. It's not that women aren't trying. They are, when it comes to short films, when it comes to documentaries, you know, the numbers are a lot more equal. It's okay for a woman to make a 20-minute documentary about any number of topics, or to make a feature-length documentary, or to make a 5-minute animation. But once we try to enter the playing field where we're talking hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars, then it's extremely rare that a woman gets an opportunity. Sarah Polley, it was just announced last week, has received funding for her next feature film from Telefilm Canada. Well, you know, and that would be a portion of all the money that she gets. It's not totally funded. But you know, like, I would hate to think that they're going, okay, now we've got our token woman. It should be 50% of the films that are made in this country are financed by our public institution, and our numbers are way down there.
Oh, well, I was about to ask, is it more difficult being a woman director in Canada, or just being a director in Canada?
It's difficult everywhere in the world. There's absolutely no question that it's a huge task to find the financing to make a film, to craft a script that can win that kind of support, and then to overcome all the hurdles that are involved in production and post-production. Everywhere in the world it's hard. It's not any easier in Hollywood than it is here. You know, when I made my first feature, and there weren't very many stats that I was aware of at the time, but it seemed to me that our numbers were up of women who had made films, feature films, and they've actually gone down. So, and that's not just in Canada. It's a problem globally.
So now that you've won this award, and it's to put together your film, which I understand is a romantic adventure comedy, and again, the title of the film is based on a true fantasy, when do you go into production, and when will we have a chance to see this film?
Well, when we go into production is a big question. As I mentioned, we don't have our financing together. This is the first big chunk in, but we're hoping we're going to shoot later this year in December, and that it would be released in 2011. And it's extremely exciting. We had some very interesting, exciting meetings this week. People are being so generous to us and so supportive, and it's just, it really feels like it's got a momentum. So we'll just keep plugging away there.
Now, do I understand you live in Dawson City?
Yes.
How did you end up above the tree line?
I just have to clarify, Dawson City is in the Yukon.
Yeah.
Which I didn't know until I ended up there. But and it's not actually above the tree line. The tree line wavers all across Canada. Again, I didn't know that until I moved north, but it's lower in the eastern Arctic than it is in the west. So we're actually surrounded by trees in Dawson City, even though we're only 3 hours, 4 hours south of the Arctic Circle. How I ended up there, I went there on a film shoot first and thought, this is just driving into town, and this is a really fantastic, unique place. It looks like you're driving into an old western town from the 1890s when the Klondike Gold Rush happened there in 1898. And then I had had a film in that festival and that happens every year in Dawson City. And so I thought, I'll just ask some artsy person about, you know, who I could talk to, who was involved with the film fest. And they pointed me in the direction of the Klondike Institute of Art and Culture, where they had just launched an artist residency program, and I got the application for that, applied, came up for a term at the artist residence, and then just couldn't leave, kept coming back until finally bought a house there.
Wow.
Every day is an adventure. It's just a phenomenally opening experience. The community is it's got lots of artists, wonderful people, adventurers, people who have been traveled a lot and come to Dawson and made it their home. People who mush into work in the morning or skedjour into work or live in log cabins off the grid, or people who live in town and log houses. You know, it's just a total mishmash, and the gold miners and the privilege of being able to get to know the First Nations community there, the Trandegwajin, being able to drive like 2 hours up the from Dawson City up the Dempster Highway, and you are in the middle of the most incredible country with only one road weaving through it for 12 hours north, and only a few small communities along the way.
Well, it sounds like you're the kind of person who follows their heart, follows their bliss, and follows their dream, and clearly you're being rewarded for it. You are currently the person who has won the Women in the Director's Chair Feature Film Award, and congratulations on that, and thank you very, very much for being on the program with us. We look forward to talking to you again when your film comes out, based on a true fantasy. Thank you for talking with us.
Thank you, Peter. It's been great.
Award-winning filmmaker Lulu Keating, the 2010 recipient of the Women in the Director's Chair Feature Film Award, presented by Creative Women Workshops Association. The film she's working on that will benefit from this award is called Based on a True Fantasy. For more information on Lulu and her work, visit her website at www.redsnapperfilms.ca. That's redsnapperfilms.ca. You can find links to Lulu's website and also the website for Creative Women Workshops Association at my website, thestufffile.com. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Coming up in just a matter of moments, Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation.
What are they saying about If the Rains Don't Cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo, is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Avidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother.
Latitude, 47 degrees, 14 minutes north. Longitude, 84 degrees, 39 minutes west. Location, Montreal, Canada. This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, Peter Anthony Holder once again brings you Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation. Lock up your daughters. And in West Virginia, your sheep. Joining Peter Anthony Holder is our intrepid embedded reporter, deep in the heartland of the U.S. of A., Stephen S. Walsh.
How you doing, Steve Areno?
Peter, I am at joy with myself.
Really?
I have no idea what that means, but I feel great. I feel wonderful. As each day goes by, I feel a lot better. I don't know why, but I do. There's something good, something wholesome about life in general.
You know, being at joy with oneself, that can cause blindness.
Let us move on, shall we?
Let's do that.
Peter, I'm shocked that you would make jokes about things like this. Here I am trying to tell you the good mood that I'm in, and you feel a need to go off in another direction. Well, I've had it with you. I've had it with you.
Are you feeling, perhaps, I don't know, spiritual?
I feel great.
Okay.
I do.
Okay.
I feel good. I feel good.
Yep.
Okay. Where shall we start this week? What do you think?
You tell me.
Well, let's see. Okay, I got one. Here we go. Dateline, St. Charles, Illinois.
That would be the land of Lincoln.
Sure would. You know, Peter, time was, a school fundraiser meant a car wash or selling candy bars. Well, times have changed, and the Music Booster Club at Central Community Unit School District 301, that's in St. Charles, Illinois, they're proving it. They're raising money this year by selling something promoters call Paca Poo. That's right. Once you get past the cute name, the stuff they're selling is actually alpaca manure. Hmm. Booster Club Secretary Gudrun Dorgan, there's a heck of a name. That sounds like Paca Poo anyway. Said it's a great garden fertilizer, and it comes in little pellets that are easy to work into the ground. Parents, students, and teachers will be scooping and selling droppings at Inspiration Farm Alpacas. A 30-pound bag will cost you $10. Farm owner Jeff Keel, he's been raising these alpacas for 4 years and usually sells the manure for profit. Apparently, alpacas digest their food more efficiently than most farm animals, so their waste doesn't smell too bad and doesn't require lengthy composting. That's good to know, isn't it?
You know, when I was a kid, I used to sell a lot of stuff for school, and there's always somebody in the neighborhood who asked the question, you know, some old grumpy Gus, what kind of crap are you kids selling now? Boy, that's a whole new meaning to this one, doesn't it?
That would be the right question to ask in this case, I think.
Absolutely.
Oh, boy. Let's move on, shall we?
Yes.
Dateline, Athens, Tennessee.
That'll be the volunteer state.
Yep. Athens police said they've arrested a door-to-door meat salesman. You got one guy selling poop door-to-door? Well, this guy is selling meat door-to-door. He swallowed a half-burned marijuana joint as people watched. 30-year-old Robert Shirk of Cleveland faces charges of tampering with evidence and resisting arrest. Athens police said officers arrested Shirk after he tossed a half-burned marijuana cigarette into his mouth and then resisted the officers' efforts to retrieve it and to take him into custody. Officers said Shirk was seated in a vehicle and they were questioning him about selling meat door-to-door without a city permit.
Well, now, what I want to know is, first of all, you don't hear very often of door-to-door salesmen anymore, which is, unfortunately, the sad reality of the society we live in. But having said that, I don't recall anybody selling meat door-to-door. Is it even possible to get a permit to sell meat door-to-door?
Apparently. No, I thought maybe it was, I don't know, beef jerky or something. No, apparently this guy was selling meat door-to-door.
Okay.
Yeah.
I can't see that being FDA approved, but anyway, let's just move on.
I can't either. Yeah. Dateline, Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin.
Ah, the Badger State.
Or as we like to call it,
the Cheese State.
Where the motto is,
if it's cheddar,
it's better. Firefighters in Wisconsin Rapids had to rescue a 20-year-old man stuck partway down a laundry chute. He had accepted a dare from children at the house, but they called 911 when the pressure of the narrow passage made it difficult for him to breathe. Crews said his legs were dangling into the basement, and they pushed him back up a little where he could breathe while other rescuers sawed the chute apart. He couldn't help himself. He was double dog dared, apparently, and he went through with it.
You know, when I was in elementary school, and I'm sure it's the same thing with you and most people, there's always some kid that you would dare to do something. Some kid who, let's be honest, was stupid enough to do something. I remember in my school, it was a kid named Christian, and it was like, Christian, why don't you flick the red switch on the wall and see what happens? Which, of course, brings the fire department.
Fire alarm, yeah.
Yeah.
And he would do it, right?
And he would do it. But even as stupid as Christian was, and I'm assuming he outgrew that at some point.
Well, yes.
This guy was an adult.
Yeah, this guy was an adult. Well, some guys will do anything. I mean, I told you the story, and we're going to do the replay one day of the story of the guy here in the great state of Missouri who put a fish into his mouth one day and swallowed it. And his last words were, "Hey, watch this."
Yeah.
Well, let's play again one day.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, though, we shall move on.
Okay.
And we shall say, Dateline, Cincinnati, Ohio.
Oh, no, Ohio. I can hardly wait to say goodbye, oh.
Oh, there's that song. It's the Buckeye State.
I used to live there, you know.
Oh, I remember.
Year of my life, I'll never get back. Oh, seems like we've had a lot of stories of people calling 911 for the wrong reasons lately. Mm-hmm. But William Ferris may win the prize. He apparently paid a prostitute $50 with the understanding that he would receive a full menu of services in the bathroom of a White Castle restaurant in Cincinnati. However, when the hooker only performed one service, Ferris, who was also expecting so much more, called 911 to report that he had been robbed.
Which service did she provide?
It involved a. It was an oral service.
Oh, okay.
She was talking dirty. Yeah. So Mr. Ferris, who incidentally is unemployed, was charged with solicitation and making a false police report. He'll also be charged with trespassing if he ever returns to that White Castle again.
Okay, now I understand the concept of him being charged with solicitation and the fact that he's not allowed to go back to White Castle.
Right.
But is it really a false police report? He paid for a service he did not get.
Yes, but the service is illegal, you see. So I don't believe you can report non-payment or non-delivery of a service which is illegal to begin with.
Oh, that the charges seem to be double-dipping, which I guess is something else he didn't get.
Let us move on, shall we?
Yes.
Dateline, Columbus, Ohio.
Oh, no, Ohio. I can hardly wait to say goodbye, oh.
Still that song, still the Buckeye State.
Yeah, still a state in which I used to live.
Oh,
and
yeah.
By the way, a city I lived in one time.
I remember.
That was the year of my life I'll never get back.
Yep.
Evelyn Burgess of Columbus hosted a family Easter dinner, but Burgess saw that her husband took notice of what her teenage second cousin was wearing, a revealing T-shirt and shorts, got upset. The outfit was inappropriate and disrespectful to wear at Easter dinner, she told officers, who responded to what happened next. The hostess and the girl fought before going outside to the car, where Burgess, who's 42, by the way, shot Danielle Pickens, 19, in the head, killing her. She was a very slim girl. Some called her Slim Pickens, but she's dead now anyway.
Well, you know, it's one of those situations where people, I guess, are missing the complete understanding and thought process behind a gathering for Easter.
I guess. And, you know, it would get me angry, Peter.
I'm sure it would.
You know what I do when I get angry, don't you?
I get an idea, yeah.
Okay, keyboard in hand, and I write a 2-minute tirade. And I've written one, if I may.
Tirade away.
Okay, it is time, as I mentioned, for the tirade. And this time out, I want to talk about mispronunciations. Now, I think the best way to start off this piece is by blasting the mispronunciation of the word mispronunciation. So many pronounce it mispronunciation, and that's just wrong. But it's a small part of a much larger overall picture that must be cleared up. We cannot allow politicians to get away with their mispronunciations. Leading the pack among recent government leaders is President George W. Bush, who apparently cannot say nuclear. He said nuclear, and that's just wrong. To be fair to W, he was not alone in this mispronunciation. President Jimmy Carter did the same. And there's about a 50-50 chance that when you see a politician on the tube talking about all things nuclear, he or she will mispronounce the word and say nuclear. And that's just wrong. Then there's the flashy and often expensive stuff many women and far too many men wear around their necks and in other places. I'm talking about jewelry. I cringe when I hear radio or TV ads with the announcer telling me where to get a great deal on jewelry. It's not jewelry, it's jewelry. It comes from the word jewel, not jewla. And this mispronunciation, Peter, is just wrong. Here in the Midwest, we see and hear a mispronunciation of the word insurance. They say insurance. You know, I've looked and cannot find a single dictionary in which the emphasis is on the first syllable. Yet, they do it, and that's just wrong. We could go on, but let's just wrap up with a Midwestern mispronunciation that has to do with distance or degree. It's the word measure. Many here mispronounce it measure. Again, I cannot find a single dictionary which has measure as the pronunciation for measure. You know, there's too much mispronunciation going on in the United States and certainly throughout the rest of the world. But it must stop because, you know what, Peter? Mispronunciations, well, they're just wrong.
Well, sir, well said. And a cunning linguist you are.
I aim to please.
Yes. And while we're on the topic of words, please say those three magic words.
Hit the theme!
This is the Stuff File.
And we're almost done with this edition of the Stuff File program. We still have an Idiot of the Day coming up in just a matter of moments, but I have one more story that I want to share with you from the Stuff File. A woman in Manchester, England claims Nintendo's Wii Fit turned her into a sex addict. Amanda Flowers fell from the game board and suffered nerve damage. Now she has persistent sexual arousal syndrome and gets turned on by everything, including vibrations from washing machines. Ooh, the spin cycle. She has to curb her condition by having at least 10 sex sessions a day and is actively looking for a super stud to satisfy her needs. Sorry, guys, I don't have her number for you. And no, I'm not holding out. I don't also have the stamina, so she's all yours if you can find her. Anyway, on to the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. This Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
Officials at Men Allen School in Uniontown, Pennsylvania say Ronald Washington, age 33, called to ask if his son had arrived at school yet. He said he needed to get something from the boy's backpack. School administrators wasted no time searching the backpack. They found two plastic bags of suspected marijuana and called police. By the time Washington arrived at the school, police were there. Putting the bags in the boy's Elmo backpack was something dumb, Washington allegedly told the trooper. He was arrested and charged with possession with intent to deliver marijuana and disorderly conduct, and he is being held on $100,000 bail. Possession with intent? Well, those are state charges. Disorderly conduct, that's a school rule violation. Either way, he faces detention. Now, I know he said that the idea of putting this in the backpack was, in his words, something dumb. But even though he recognizes this fact, he's still an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, number 0035. Hope you enjoyed it. Tell all your friends. Let's get the word out. The website, if you want to check things out on this show, is thestufffile.com, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests on the What's On page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and again, this show is number 0035. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook at facebook.com/PAHolder and Twitter at twitter.com/PAHolder. Hope to see you back here for our next show, on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, streaming on PCJMedia.com, and over the air on World FM 88.5 FM in New Zealand. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.